Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And, yeah, if it doesn't sound like I'm on Zoom, you're darn right. I'm not on Zoom. I'm sitting in the back garden of our guest, man, his name, Brian Terry. You know, most people know him for the vegan cookbook or the Afro-Vegan cookbook, but we were just joking. He has like 6 or 7 books, and his newest one is called Black Food. He's launched an imprint where he is now allowing other people to put their recipes together, and he's publishing them. And the latest venture involves a 13-year-old, I believe, from the town. And so 16. Well, you know, 13, 16, it's all the same to me, you know. Once you turn 30, man, it's all the same, you know. But anyway, Brian Terry is a force. When he's not cooking for presidents and Jay-Z and, you know, other luminaries, he's hard at work, you know, being a prolific writer. So welcome to the show, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for coming over. Glad we can meet in person in these perilous times.
You know, you've always been about wealth. I mean, not wealth, but health.
That too.
But
that
that's
too, 'cause health is wealth.
Health is wealth. I was going to say that. But I wanted to ask you, because we come out of the hip-hop generation, and, you know, just in the past 6 months, we've lost so many people. You know, Shock G, DMX, Black Rob are the latest. Prior to that, MF Doom, Steezo, Prince Marky D. We lost Ecstasy from Houdini. And, I mean, the list goes on. You know, the last count that I looked at, there are over 50 rap artists who passed prematurely in the past 2 years from health issues. And not that rap artists are any better than regular folks, but since we are a society that looks at the state of things through the eyes of those who are the most visible celebrities, we see those as microcosms as to what's going on. So if I'm naming off Shock and all these other people, I also lost my old roommate. I lost somebody else I went to school. So I'm looking at people who have just hit 50, and all of them pass from bad health, mm-hmm. even though two of them were athletes. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to get your take on it, because now over the past few years, we've seen a lot of people going, you know, I'm not going to have that hamburger. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that vegan thing ain't that bad, right? I know you're having these discussions. Mm-hmm. And since you've been in the middle of this from jump, and I would say, respectfully carrying a baton from what was going on when you had Elijah Muhammad and others putting out their books about eating way back in the 60s. Yep. You know, how are you seeing the state of things, especially in lieu of what's been happening with, you know, our peers?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you mentioned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because something I've been pushing back against since I started doing this work is this idea that somehow eating healthfully, eating vegetarian, vegan, plant-based, however you want to describe it, isn't for us. And, you know, in the past, they've been kind of framed as these upper middle class, suburban practices that a lot of white people had. And then more recently, we kind of think about these practices as something that we see among like young white hipsters living in urban gentrified cities, right? And my work has really been about highlighting this thread of Black-led food and health activism throughout the 20th century. My first contact with these issues came when I learned about plant-based eating from Black Seventh-day Adventists. You know, the Seventh-day Adventists have a clear theological, you know, theologically driven kind of approach to eating healthfully, right? I think about the books and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, whether you agree with everything they're dropping. Look, he had a health ministry. You know, he wrote 2 books, How to Eat to Live, which was about rejecting what he talked about as the white man's food. But I think that was, you know, his way of saying this industrialized processed package, colonial foods, all these ways in which traditional indigenous food practices have been disrupted by white folks, right? And so we can go from there. We could talk about Rastafarians with their Itau approach to eating, which is organic and natural. We could talk about people like KRS-One, who is talking about factory farming and veganism and eating healthfully back in the 90s. You know, it goes on and on. And I just want to mention this because I think that we need to understand that, you know, these traditions are as much ours as anyone else. When you look at the traditional diets in West and Central Africa, in the American South, in the Caribbean and Latin America, wherever Black people have gone, the traditional diets are largely vegetable centric. You know, mostly. I mean, if you think about Sub-Saharan Africa, it's like a huge continent, obviously. But, you know, West and Central Africa, many of the diets largely revolved around plants. And meat was often used to supplement, to add more nutritional density. But in terms of having, like, meat at every single meal here in the United States, working class and working poor Black folks simply couldn't afford to do that before our food system was industrialized and the prices got so cheap that you could have it at every meal. And so I always say we need to be looking back to these practices. How are, you know, Nana and Big Mama and, you know, just like their mamas, how were they eating that was natural and close to the land? You know, these things that we often don't associate with us. You know, I think it's this cultural amnesia, because when I go and give talks, I often start by saying, well, how many people grew up in a family that had farms or, you know, home gardens, or y'all, you know, were active in community gardens, or your folks canned and pickle and preserve. And by the end of the questioning, most people have their hands up. But it's also this sense of, oh, man, I forgot about that. Yeah, I used to go to, you know, Big Mama had this huge garden in the backyard, or we used to go to my great granddaddy's farm out in rural Mississippi or whatever. And so I just want to encourage us to recognize that these practices for our overall health and well-being and longevity are they're already there. We just need to remember, piece back these histories together, and then try to figure out how to incorporate them in this modern context.
Is the amnesia a result of marketing and moving entire populations to be consummate consumers of, you know, a very profitable industry? I'm saying this, you know, it's not by accident that people would associate vegetarianism with something outside the Black community.
Yeah.
Almost to the point that some people would say that, you know, you're trying to be bougie if you go in that sort of direction.
Yeah.
There are some cultures and some families where they frowned upon. Why'd you be a vegetarian? Right. We're here in Memphis, you know, but you are from Tennessee.
Growing up.
How did that come about? Is this really to move people in a direction where they start purchasing something that they really don't need? And let me just add it with this. You know, I asked this question remembering that Oprah Winfrey got sued by the beef industry because came on her show and said, no, y'all shouldn't be eating this.
Yeah.
And it went and sued her,
yeah.
You know, and she had to kind of back down.
Yeah.
She didn't double down. I don't know if you would have doubled down, but she backed out.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is this about?
Well, I think there is this issue that I've often discussed, the aggressive marketing of the worst foods and the worst beverages in our communities. We know that these multinational food corporations are mostly invested in profit. That's what they're about. They're trying to make the most profits for their shareholders, and they care little about public health. They care a little about anything besides making money. And so, you know, what's criminal to me, I founded an organization called Be Healthy in New York back in 2001. And when we talk to the young people, mostly from the five boroughs, mostly from the lower economic strata of New York City, and these folks are living in neighborhoods that are often described as food deserts. That term has largely been rejected by a lot of far left food activists. We prefer the term food apartheid now, because I think that squarely, it puts the reality that these are structural inequalities that prevent people from having access to healthy, fresh, affordable food. So, you know, in terms of the reasons that people have that cultural amnesia, the reason that people overconsume a lot of fast food and junk food are very complicated. But I do want to highlight the fact that a lot of these food and beverage corporations, they try to expand their markets in Black and brown communities, in low-income communities, because they know that they can, you know, market these cheap products to people who often don't have a lot of disposable income. You know, folks who are living in communities that have very few jobs and the jobs that are available aren't paying a living wage. Yeah, well, 99 cents menu makes sense. And so what I encourage us to do is understand that this problem around, you know, health that we're seeing in the African-American community and in many communities of color, specifically in working class and working poor communities. But, you know, folks are just suffering across the board. But one, we need to push back against, like, there literally needs to be policies that prevent these corporations from spending billions of dollars aggressively marketing to children. Let's just start there. It's criminal that these corporations don't have any restrictions around it the way that they can start. They try to cultivate these consumers as young as 2 years of age.
Well, I worked at big companies like that where they said create a habit that's hard to kick. Yeah. You know, Time Warner was one, you know, Clear Channel was the other. But it makes sense that they would do that. But it's interesting because you can't market cigarettes to them.
Yeah.
And you can't market alcohol to them, but you can market sugar and junk food to them. Yeah. with reckless abandon.
Exactly. And we know, I mean, it's not like the data isn't there. We know that the overconsumption of processed and packaged and foods that are high in salt, high in fat, high in sugar, we know the detrimental impact that it has on our health. But I also want us to be aware of the barriers that many communities have to accessing healthy, fresh, affordable food, right? As you know, there are communities where, as a buddy of mine said, you could find a gun quicker than you could find an organic apple. You know, these communities that are suffering from food apartheid, they're dealing with a number of barriers, whether it's economic, whether it's physical, whether it's geographic. You know, when I first moved here from Brooklyn in 2008, there was a study that showed in West Oakland, there were 53 corner stores and liquor stores and not one single full service supermarket. Now we have the market started by Brahma Mahdi, the former founder of the People's Grocery. It's the People's Kitchen. So this People's Grocery in West Oakland, now it is a full service market for people there. But the reality is, even though it's there, there are a lot of people in that community who still couldn't afford to shop there, as much as they try to make the prices affordable. And so what that says to me is that we can't look at food and food access and, you know, the public health crisis that a lot of communities are facing in a vacuum. We need to understand that in most communities where there's a very little access to healthy, fresh, affordable and culturally appropriate food, there are very few jobs, as I mentioned earlier, and the ones that they have typically don't pay a living wage. There's often very little green space for people to be active. So how are you going to tell people they need to be exercising and out in the street when they don't even feel safe, or there isn't like a you know, designated space for people to like run and exercise and be active? Often these communities are dealing with environmental racism. We know that a lot of these industries that wouldn't go into any other communities, they'll put in the black and brown neighborhoods. And so people are suffering from that. And so I just want us to have a holistic view while we're addressing food and health, also thinking about the wide range of issues that we're dealing with. Trust me, if a lot of people in the neighborhoods had economic security, they had jobs in the community, they had money in their pockets, they would make different decisions about eating more healthfully because they
if the habit hasn't kicked in.
Yeah, I mean the habits, but
because you don't know it's a habit, you don't know it, and it's an addiction. If you don't realize it's a habit, man, I need to have my sugar just like I need to have my coffee. I need to have my cookies. I need to, you know, I'm going to have my hamburger. And then it becomes, in my opinion, how you define yourself. Man, I eat steak every night. You know, that's what I do. You do that vegetarian stuff. A real man, you know, eats steak. You know, that's so, I mean, people grew up like that.
It's true. I mean, these are habits and attitudes and politics that have been ingrained in us from day one. And I think that's why people who are on the ground in communities, and big up to the food justice activists who have been on the ground working in communities for decades. You know, I always say that this work continues. It's been happening. You know, Dick Gregory is one of the most prominent black folks in the 1970s that was talking about, you know, the multiple diets that he went on to like get healthy, from like vegetarianism to veganism to fruitarianism. I think that brother said he was a breatharian for a day. And so, you know, there are people who are standing on Dick Gregory's and other shoulders. And I think these are the folks that we need to listen to, because folks have been doing the work and they have some of the keys to disrupting these habits, because habits are hard to break. But I think, as you said earlier, with all these brothers dying far too soon, we got to break these habits. We got to break out these patterns, because, you know, we're getting attacked on every level. And I think if we can at least think about how we can hold each other and eat well and try to de-stress so we can live longer, that's one key to the liberation. But there are a lot of other areas that we need to be addressing, obviously, for, you know, self-determining liberation. But the food and health is something that I think we need to be putting energy into.
I asked you about the people that passed away, and, you know, we'll put aside for a moment, you know, substance abuse, which probably contributes, but that's not everybody who I named, right? Yeah. Not by a long shot. Are we a generation that is now going to see the piper being paid for 40, 50 years of aggressive junk food marketing, McDonald's commercials, Burger King, Coca-Cola, Sprite, you know, all that. And you know, these folks have had, you know, they've ingrained themselves in our communities. When other people wouldn't sponsor our events, they would.
Yeah.
They're the ones that showed up. So, you know, on one hand, they've been very good. You know, they sponsored the Juneteenth. Yeah. You want me to heat healthy? McDonald's sponsored Juneteenth. Did you? You know what I'm saying? You want me to eat healthy? Well, this concert that we have, big shout out to Red Bull or to Sprite. They're the ones that sponsored, right? So you have that sort of economic reality that, hey, man, they paid a bill.
Yeah.
And they allowed us to now associate them with a cultural enriching type of event,
yeah,
that are embedded in our memory.
Yeah.
But 30, 40 years of that, are we now starting to see, and you tell me from your understanding of food and diet, does it kick in and say, hey, man, you know, you're on a credit card, now it's time. Your heart is weakened, your arteries are clogged, all these other things. Are we going to start seeing this become a much more common thing? In other words, they said this generation will be the ones that die sooner than their parents.
That, you know, when I learned that fact about 20 years ago, that was a major impetus for me deciding to do this work. Like, that just doesn't make sense that a generation will have a shorter lifespan than their parents' generation, right? The idea, I've always been taught that as we advance technologically and scientifically, we be living longer. And so, you know, that's problematic. But just, you know, to your point about like a lot of these multinational food and beverage corporations sponsoring events in the Black community, they, you know, they have shown up, but it's blood money. And, you know, I think it puts people in a tricky position, because
is it blood money when you're desperate? Look, we want to have a Juneteenth, right? And I'm going to go to, you know, we could start naming all the healthy places. They're not here. They're not around. But that fast food joint, they're around. They write a big check.
Yeah.
And they're saying, y'all can have fun to do this Juneteenth. We got you. You know, when we were coming up in hip hop, there were a lot of places that was like, nah, we'll stay away.
Yeah.
But the people that did it, Seagram's,
yeah,
OD, right? And soft drinks.
Yeah.
And so you can't, you know, is it fair to even, was it blood money? It's like, man, it wasn't blood money when I took it.
Well, to be clear, I'm not blaming the victim here. I understand why people are in a position where they feel like it makes sense to take the money from these corporations. I'm blaming the system. I'm blaming capitalism. I'm blaming white supremacy. I'm blaming a system that puts people in a position where they feel like, you know, one of the few options that they have for economic security for their organization, for cultural events, is by getting money from these companies that are literally killing us because of the foods that they inundate our communities with. And I just want to be clear, because I think a lot of people, this is something I've seen often and heard, this knee-jerk blaming of the victim. You know, well, if those folks just ate more healthfully, then they wouldn't get, you know, type 2 diabetes or hypertension or certain cancers. And look, once again, there is a certain level of responsibility that we all have to have, but you can't tell somebody they need to be eating healthfully when there aren't options in their neighborhood for them to eat healthfully. Well, okay, so you live in West Oakland. There aren't any supermarkets. They're just the corner stores that have a lot of cigarettes and alcohol and a lot of junk food. Why don't you go to the more affluent parts of Oakland? Or why don't you go to Berkeley? You know, why don't you go to Emeryville? And the answer is, imagine being like a elderly person, you know, who doesn't have a vehicle, and you're trying, the only way you get around is public transportation. You gonna tell me you're supposed to go to Berkeley Bowl and then get your weeks of groceries there? What if you're a single mom and you're working 2-3 jobs because the jobs don't pay a living wage and you're just trying to make money to take care of your family? You know, like, these are the realities that people are dealing with, and I don't think it makes sense to blame them. We need to look at the structural impediments for people having good transportation, from people having, jobs that pay a living wage, communities that are livable and active, all these things. So this is something you do so brilliantly, Davey. I always feel like you know how to, like, take people's kind of, like, initial response that's often letting the larger structural forces off the hook and be like, no, like, let's turn our eyes around and look at who the real enemy is. And so I'm saying that we have to be both, and this is just the work that Black folks and other historically marginalized communities have always have to do. We need to be, like, self-responsible and taking care of ourselves, and we also need to be looking at how we can organize for self-determination to create our own institutions outside of these mainstream institutions. Because if 2020 didn't teach us anything, it should have taught us that capitalism don't care for us, white supremacy don't care for us, and dare I say, America doesn't care for us.
Right. Well, we should have ideally learned that during Katrina. I mean, but you know,
the list goes on and on, right?
But let's come back to another thing. We're talking with author, food justice advocate, food freedom fighter, Brian Terry, talking about his new imprint, you know, Black Food, Black for Food. Is it Black Food or Black for Food?
Black Food is the book. For Color. Oh, so my new book project is Black Food, which is an anthology that includes recipes, art, and stories from over 100 contributors throughout the Black diaspora. Talking about folks on the African continent, the Caribbean, here in North America, Latin America, and beyond. And the new imprint that I have is Four Color Books. That's the number Four Color Books. It's an imprint of Penguin Random House and 10 Speed Press. And we're all about supporting BIPOC creatives to make sure that their work can get published and their ideas can get out there. And that's the next step in the empire.
There you have it. I want to come back to this other thing, and we kind of glossed over it, but let's talk about addictions. Food is an addiction. You know, and so maybe it's good if I'm addicted to, you know, healthy fruit versus sugar. But can we talk about the power of this addiction? Because what it reminded me is people would stand on a soapbox and talk about people need to make better choices. They somehow overlook the addictions that people have, which are intentional in terms of the folks who market it. And I tell people, well, if it's so easy to get rid of an addiction, toss away your iPhone. You know, don't go on social media for a week.
Yeah.
Toss that away, since addictions are so easy. And most people, not only can't they won't. They'll fight you.
Yeah.
Well, no, we're not talking about me, brother. We're talking about, no. I will give up these cookies and this fast food if you give up your social media and your smartphone for a month. Let's do it a month. You know, I'll fast for a month. You fast for a month. And, I got to go to work and I got to feed these kids.
Yeah.
And I'm only working 2 jobs, and, you know, so 99-cent McDonald's is cool. Mm-hmm. So, again, you give up this phone and your social media, and I'll fast for a month in the way that you want, and we'll all be healthy, right? We'll all get rid of the addiction,
yeah.
Is in theory. But it doesn't really work like that. And then I think I'm bringing this up because it seems like once you lock in, it's hard to break. So, ideally, we lock in on a good habit,
yeah.
But we've been socialized to lock in on a bad habit,
yeah.
Disguised as a good thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the work you're doing, how can you get people to get rid of it? I'll be honest, I ain't going to be a vegan.
I mean, and look, let me be clear. My goal as a activist, as someone, a community builder, as someone who's really deeply committed to transforming public health and our food system, I don't think everybody should be a vegan. Now, to be clear, there are a number of peer-reviewed studies that have shown that a low-fat, plant-based diet with a diversity of foods can actually be very important in terms of helping to prevent chronic illnesses. In some cases, obviously ameliorating the symptoms of many diet-related illnesses, and in some cases, reversing them. The Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in D.C. has been doing work for decades about the role of a healthful plant-based diet reversing type 2 diabetes. And so, you know, the work is happening. We know that it can be a good thing to have a diet that's replete in lots of, you know, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and nuts and legumes. But that being said, we're all different. You know, we have different bodily constitutions, cultural food ways, age, health status. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's one panacea. There's no perfect diet. There's no perfect diet for anyone throughout his or her life. It may be great for you, Davey, to be a raw food guy for 6 months. But then when the winter hits and you're less active and it's cold, you might need to be eating some warming foods. And that's why I always tell people that we shouldn't get so dogmatic about this idea of what the perfect diet is without taking into all these considerations. I mean, one thing that I feel like is a criteria that's often missing from the way that we talk about eating healthfully is culturally relevant foods. What were the foods that we've been eating, you know, historically, our ancestors, but, you know, even before our industrialized food system, what were our great grandparents eating? What foods were they surviving on? And so I feel like we need to take all these things in consideration. But the thing about addictions is, you know, they can be like socially kind of induced, but addictions are often physiological, right? Yep. And so a lot of people literally are addicted to sugar. You know, if they had to give up sugar for a week, their withdrawal symptoms, headaches, fatigue, you know, all these type of impacts. And so I think that we need to understand that the reality that a lot of people are dealing with, they've been eating this food for so long that their body literally craves it, and it needs to be a hard reset. And look, I'm not a physician, I'm not a dietitian, I'm not a nutritionist, but I know that a lot of people are doing work and kind of helping people to slowly and organically shift their food habits. And look, let me just speak from my perspective. When I founded this organization, Be Healthy in New York, we had young people. These are mostly high school students, right? People come in. These young people be like, I haven't eaten vegetables since I was 7 years old. Or I don't drink water. I only drink sodas. And I know this may seem absurd to some people, but this was the reality that these young people were dealing with. And what we saw is when we got them involved in going to farmers markets and the food co-ops and even like community gardens and some rural farms, when they got a chance to learn about how food was grown, because they were living in neighborhoods where they literally thought that food just came in plastic containers because that's what they saw in the markets in their neighborhood. But when they went to these places and learned about the seed-to-table cycle, then took the food or harvested the food, and we brought it back to the door where we were based, and these young people made the food, they tried it because it was their creation. And the more they tried different foods, the more it opened up their palate, and the more that they actually realized that these habits were starting to break. And I think as educators, as people who care about communities, who want to see the health of our communities improve, we just need to celebrate the small victories. If we saw these young people coming in at the end of the year with the bottles that we gave them at the beginning filled up with water instead of Cokes, that was a huge victory. When they would come in with dry fruit or fresh fruit, you know, as their snack, those were huge victories. And I think we need to take an incremental approach to healing our communities and not expecting that everyone's going to change overnight. And I think that's what a lot of the more dogmatic folks who want to push certain dietary models on communities feel like people just need to like turn a switch and they're going from eating a standard American diet to eating a vegan diet the next day. Things don't work like that. People need time to transition. And I think that we need, once again, we need to be working on like that internal work of healing our communities while also holding power accountable, because that's the corporations, the government, and all these institutions that should be protecting our communities haven't been, and we need to hold them, their feet to the fire.
We're talking with author Brian Terry. If you're just tuning in, it's Hard Knock Radio. Let me ask you this. You have, what, 6 books?
Black Food's my 6th book, so.
Yeah.
We here.
Didn't you say it all in the first book? I mean, what makes them all different? I mean, it's like, all right, I got these recipes, you know. What's happening? I mean, obviously you're not just recycling stuff.
Yeah.
So what's, you know, how do you do 6 books on food?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that, Dave, because it's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And, like, I often, in the past, would look back at my old books and cringe. Like, oh, I can't believe I did that. And that recipe sucks. And what was I thinking about when I wrote that? And what I realized is that that's just a wrong-headed approach. And, you know, I would be critical of, like, Spike Lee because he talk about he hates She's Gotta Have It. He'd never watch his ad. And, you know, he would often talk negatively about his older films. And I love everything in this body of work, or most things, I'll say, in this body of work. But I get it as a creative now because you keep growing in your craft and then you get better and better. And so now my reframing of those old books is I was publicly practicing. I mean, the books have value and they're great. And people love Vegan Soul Kitchen. People love Afro Vegan. People, you know, adore those books that I often am like, I hate them. Get them on my face. But I recognize that if I didn't work on those books and make the mistakes and not do the stellar book that I thought I should do in hindsight, then I wouldn't have gotten to the place where I got Vegetable Kingdom, my book that came out last year and was commercially successful, critically acclaimed, won an NAACP Image Award, was, you know, one of the books that was on the most best cookbooks of the year list in 2020. It was because of the mistakes I made in the past and all the practice that I did with those other books that helped me create such a masterpiece. And the same thing with my next book. And so, you know, I even will revisit like recipes that I might have had in the older ones. I'll do them over because I'm like, oh, I could do it even better now in this third or fourth book. And so I just want to say that to people who are listening. As a creative person, we just have to be unafraid to take risks, unafraid to get the work out there, even if it's not perfect, and just see it as practice and see it as just being in process. And if you do it, you'll get better.
In Vegetable Kingdom, where you won that Image Award, what's that about? What's in it? Is it, you know?
Vegetable Kingdom was largely driven by my desire for my children to fall in love with a diversity of vegetables. You know, what our oldest daughter, it wasn't a big reach because when, this is a little, some parenting game, when we had our oldest daughter and we started her on solid foods, we didn't give her fruit until 6 months in to her even eating solid foods. And my perspective, and my wife agreed, was that it's easy to fall in love with like fruits, like, you know, that's nature's candy. But an American palate, I think, is very simplistic. You know, people don't appreciate like bitter as a flavor, which is important. A lot of bitter foods actually are really healing. And so, as you know, as a parent, the kind of energy you could put into the first one, you often don't have that same energy for the second one. So we didn't have more of a structured approach to our second daughter. And so she just eats bread, pasta, crackers, like she could just eat carbs all day. And so this book was really about them being on this journey of me making this book and also helping them eat all the recipes so that they fall in love with them.
That's funny you said that because my youngest is the one that will eat bread and all that all day. Where my oldest, who's the same age as your daughter,
yep,
she's more like, you know, I'm not eating any meat. Huh? No meat, no chicken, you know, just vegetables. But my son,
yeah,
he's like, you know, put some ice cream in front of him, he'll go to town and
to
call it a day. So, yeah, you know, we have to smash down on him. But, you know, they're smart. They're like, well, you ate ice cream.
Yeah.
Why can't I? You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, and so I'm glad you mentioned that because one thing that I'm very clear about, the most powerful parenting tool we can have or take advantage of is modeling. We can say what we want all day, but kids look at what we're doing and then they will often, you know, mimic what we're doing.
Some of the things that were challenging, especially when you're working a lot, was food prep. Mm. And, you know, people fell in love with the microwave and that helped things. And then one day they said, no, don't use the microwave. So, you know, I don't have a microwave no more, you know. But now you can't tell me, and please don't tell me, the Instapot where I make my greens, right? The air fryer where, in fact, this morning just woke up, made my fish, you know, it's done, right? Has that changed the game? Is that helping or are we cheating? You know, because I'm going to be honest, I eat greens every day now because I can Instapot them. It's not a 4-hour journey.
Yeah.
Rinse, put them in, and then, you know, yeah. My thing is I add raisins and other stuff to it, and people are like, don't do that, but it's my thing,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah,
it tastes good. You know, I season it. And so
now how you do it.
The raisin man, the current man.
I mean, look, I'm not going to talk badly about any of these technologies that allow people to cook more efficiently. And I think, you know, people love to shame people, especially. And I'm really glad that one of my colleagues and mentors, Psyche Williams Forsum, who's a professor at University of Maryland, she actually has a new book coming out about food shaming and how Black folks are often the target of food shaming. And I think that just comes with anti-Black racism. It comes with classism. And I just don't like this way in which poor people, folks of color, people who may not have the means to, you know, take 2 hours like I do to make a meal in the middle of the week. You know, I'm in a position to do that. But a lot of people, as I said, who are working.
And yeah, that's what you do for a living.
And that's the work, you know. But I just feel like, you know, people need to do what they need to do. And I think that these technologies can be useful. But I think capitalism, it so often convinces us that every problem that we need to address, we need to do it as an individual. I'm gonna fix this myself. And I think we need to have a more collective and communal mindset when thinking about addressing this public health crisis, right? And so, yeah, for a working mom of a couple kids grinding, it is probably super challenging to make home-cooked meals every day of the week. But imagine this. Imagine if you, me, Waylon, Adam, we all went to the farmer's market on Saturday morning, and we just got a diversity of fruits and vegetables and whatever we needed. And we pooled our money so that not just one of us were paying, but we were splitting the cost. And then we go back to Adam's crib, and we all make, you make a casserole. Waylon makes a pot of stew. Adam makes a big ribeye steak or whatever. And then we have fresh home-cooked meal that we can divide among each other. We could freeze some of it. We could put it away. And then we all can eat well throughout the week. Think about all these churches, Davey, that have these amazing, huge industrial kitchens that have been sitting there just unused for decades. What if they opened them up and said, community, let's come in. We're going to build a garden at the church or a little urban farm. We want people who are in the church not just to come and get their spiritual nourishment, but you can come and get these fresh vegetables that you can harvest from the farm. And when you come on Saturday, we're going to have a canning and pickling and preserving class so that all the strawberries you got won't go to rot, and you can actually make you some strawberry jam. And then on Sunday, we're going to bring everybody in, and we're going to collectively make some soups, some stews, some casseroles, and then everybody could take their fresh cooked meals home for the week, and you got good meals throughout the week. That's the type of mindset that we have to have.
It's interesting. That's what we did when I was coming up, but it was out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, yo, you know, check this out. You know,
yep.
We going over to Nana's, and we going to grab these, you know, these Tupperware things,
right? Exactly.
You know, and then we're going to go and, you know, and bounce back and have the food for a week. But yeah, that's kind of what, I don't know if they pulled the money,
yeah.
But definitely it was like, come get yourself a plate.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm one of the people. I keep the Tupperware in the car.
No doubt.
I'm not ashamed, man. You know, if I go to an event,
yeah.
If I come to your house and you're like, hey, man, you know, there's some leftovers. Well, you know, I'm prepared. Say, brother, I got a Tupperware thing in the car. Hold on a second, you know. Let me go.
And that's how we gotta be. And you know, I'd be remiss when I was talking about a lot of my influences and the people upon whose shoulders I stand if I didn't mention the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And you know, I always make it a point to use their full name when they were founded. I know colloquially we call them the Black Panthers, but you know, I think it's important that we just take a second to reflect on that name, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Why? As you know, they were founded because they were addressing the same issues that Black Lives Matter and any people of conscience have been out protesting in the streets for years, decades, beyond. Police brutality. Black folks who are dealing with police coming into their West Oakland specifically and violating people's rights and sometimes killing Black people. And that's where they started, but they knew that that was only one piece of the puzzle. And that's why they had their survival programs, their over 60 programs that were addressed created to address the basic needs of people living in community. And that's how you got the grocery giveaways and the free breakfast for children program. But you also had the sickle cell anemia testing and the services that took seniors to the supermarket and took people to visit family in prisons and took people to their doctor's appointments. So that framing, that approach is just what I'm talking about. We can't just look at food. We have to look at the range of material conditions that people are living with. And how can we improve them? And I think that it's also important to just recognize that, I mean, look, people can choose to opt into the system or not, but we have to create our parallel institutions. We have to take care of ourselves. We need to be creating our own businesses. We need to create our own gardens and farms. We need to be doing whatever we need to do to be self-determined and take care of ourselves. Because if we wait on this government, if we wait on these corporations, like you said, we're going to be out here like my people in New Orleans were when Katrina hit, standing on top of roofs begging for help. And so we got to get ahead of it.
Real talk. Brian, marching orders for folks that are listening, in terms of tapping into the work that you are doing, you know, the black food, the four color, you know, imprint that you have. What do you want us to look out for? And what would you ask us to do now?
Well, I would love for people to pre-order black food from your favorite independent bookstore. Big up to Marcus Books here in Oakland. But yeah, pre-order sales make a big difference in terms of a lot. So if you can do that. And I also want to invite authors. If you are an author and you have an idea for a book and you could put a book proposal together, send it our way. We're looking for projects. We're actively building our list. As you mentioned, we have our first acquisition was a cookbook of Rahana Bizarret Martinez, a 16-year-old chef here in Oakland. She was the finalist on Top Chef Junior when she was 13. And she's cooked at some of the most critically acclaimed restaurants around the world. So we're publishing her first book in 2023. We're building a list from there. And I know what I know, but there's a lot of brilliance and dope projects out there that I have no idea about. So, you know, you can send it to the submissions page on our website. You can go to my website, Bryant, Bryant-Terry.com on IG. It's Bryant Terry. I'm mostly active on IG in terms of social media, but check out the Four Color Books page, learn about what we're about. And if you feel like your project might be a good fit, send it over. We'd love to take a look. I'm invested in using my positionality and power and, you know, just experience in this industry to help uplift and uplift BIPOC, creatives, but also help to do what I can to diversify media.
There you have it. That's the voice of Bryant Terry. Yeah, and we're sitting here doing it live. Well, you know, at least not on Zoom. So we decided not to do that. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Yeah. Now, Rupanai. Hip learning.